Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode here of Crime and Science Radio, hosted, of course, by Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is Building a Better Law Enforcement, an interview with Chief Scott LaChasse from the Burbank Police Department here in Southern California. So without any further ado, let's hit it off to our hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everyone. I'm really so happy to have Scott LaChasse here with us tonight. I admire him so much. This is someone who has seen law enforcement from top to bottom and over a long period of time. He has 36 years of experience in law enforcement and security and joined the Burbank Police Department as interim chief in January 2010 and has been its permanent chief since April of 2013. During his time before that, he was with the LAPD for many years, also did some work for some major corporations in security. And we're going to talk to him about all of that and hopefully give our audience members a better handle on what's going on in this very interesting time, as you might say, for law enforcement. Welcome, Scott.
And welcome to you, too. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, welcome, Scott. It's great to have you here. You have a very interesting career, and it all started, these many years ago with the LAPD in 1970. Tell us about your background and what led you to law enforcement in the first place.
Well, I always had an interest in working with people and always had an interest in an action-oriented type environment, and that led me to law enforcement or the military. So I had signed up for the Marine Corps platoon leaders class, thinking I would go into the military as an officer after I graduated from college, and then serve my country in the Marine Corps. And then I was thinking about becoming an FBI agent, and that was one way to satisfy the qualifications at that time. And during that process, this was back in the 60s, I started as a student worker, which is a cadet-type program for the Los Angeles Police Department. And it took only a short period of time for me to get hooked on that.
Well, what division did you work in when you were there, and what was your routine like then? What kind of things did you get involved in?
Well, I was there starting in 1970 as a regular police officer, and my first assignment was in Hollywood Division, and it was a completely different environment then. I remember a lot of out-of-control riots in parks on Sundays. I remember a lot of demonstrations because of the anti-war sentiment that pervaded the nation. We saw a resurgence of heroin then, which means there were a lot of burglaries and a lot of hypes on the streets of Hollywood in particular. And this was a time when I can remember as a young police officer handling as many 20 radio calls in an 8-hour shift, and you just went from one call to another without stopping.
Wow. That's pretty high-octane stuff. So you start out as an officer on the streets, but you also rose quite high in the LAPD ranks, which is, and maybe we should talk just a little about the size of the organization for listeners who might not be in the LA area, but it's a huge organization. So can you kind of give us a quick overview of the department and your career there?
Sure. In talking about the department, the Los Angeles Police Department is the second largest law enforcement agency in the country in terms of sworn personnel, with about 10,000 people. New York is far beyond the LAPD in terms of the total number of people. They're about 35,000. I don't know where Chicago fits right now. It's gone back and forth, but it's a large organization, and it's very demanding. Anytime you work in a major metropolitan environment, particularly today, you're dealing with a lot of changing demographics. You're dealing with a lot of homelessness. And crime is up and down. Much of our crime in Los Angeles today and in the neighboring communities, like where I'm working in Burbank now, is related to property crime. And there are a lot of mental illness issues to deal with, as well as people that have substance abuse issues. So it's quite overwhelming.
Just to sort of talk about some of the positions you held there, you, as you're saying, you started off as an officer in Hollywood Division. Where did you go from there?
I worked several different assignments in Hollywood Division. Eventually, as a police officer, went to Training Division and was involved in doing a lot of management training at that time. Then went back to Hollywood as a young detective. Made sergeant in 1974 and went to Wilshire Division as a field sergeant. Worked there for a couple of years as a sergeant. Eventually went back to Training Division and worked in recruit training. And we were at that time hiring 100 folks every four-week interval.
Wow.
And then went to some staff assignments, eventually made lieutenant in 1979, worked staff assignments again, the communications division, went back to training, and this time in the capacity of specialized training. And eventually made captain and went to 77th Street, which is South Central Los Angeles. I was back and forth there a couple times, separated by a stint at Valley Traffic Division. Then I was the area commanding officer back at 77th, which means I was in charge of both the patrol force as well as the detective contingent, made commander, and ended up working an assignment trying to spend almost $200 million to try to build new police stations and new police academy, which was a great assignment. And then I really had some fun, action-oriented positions in the 90s. Went to something called Uniform Services that was comprised of our tactical planning, Metropolitan, SWAT. And it was a great job because if you remember the 90s, it started off with the civil disorders. In 1992, we went through several different major fires, wildland fires. We had the earthquake in 94. And all told, during that period of time, I believe we had six presidentially declared disasters, which was an awful lot to deal with in a relatively short period of time. And bounced around and ended up in back into a criminal intelligence capacity. And at that particular time, this is prior to 9/11, and was working anti-terrorism, narcotics, organized crime. So that was another great job where I really developed good relationships with a lot of allied agencies, particularly the federal agencies. Eventually made chief, and then went back to South Bureau, which is an area in Los Angeles that's roughly south of the Santa Monica Freeway all the way down to the harbor. So it comprises a lot of nice areas, but it also comprises some areas that are very needy and in a state at that time and continues to be of transformation.
Right. That's a very – also the South Side is very – you have – as you said, you know, as all of LA is, where you have the very wealthy living, you know, right next to areas where people are, it's high density population and often poverty, you know, and high crime areas. So that, as you're saying, that's a really active area. It's a huge area of LA. It's also really a very mixed area. So, and you were saying with criminal intelligence, to kind of go back to that for a minute, what specifically are they charged with doing? Because I think a lot of people misunderstand what those activities are about.
Okay, the Anti-Terrorist Division is now, I believe, called Major Crimes Division, and it's a part of the Counterterrorism Bureau of LAPD. But even then, it was very action-oriented because there were some seminal events in the United States in the early 1990s when, again, the World Trade Center was targeted. And there was more and more intelligence about things starting to happen around the world and venues in the United States that were targeted. So it was quite an exciting time to be involved in that particular line of work. It was, yes, pre 9/11, but it was after some of the other events, and we knew about some of the actors that ended up carrying out these dastardly deeds later on. But to be involved at that particular time and to see the cooperation amongst all of the law enforcement agencies, and I give all the federal agencies, the FBI and the Secret Service, the DEA credit, because we all came together. We started working in fusion centers. We had a joint terrorism task force that was established, actually to go back to around the period of the 84 Olympics. But when I first came on the police department in 1970, there was not a lot of cooperation amongst the various state, federal, and local agencies. But circumstances caused us to really form tight partnerships and to see us come together for the good of the country and the good of our communities was really great. And so I got to see a lot of that develop. And it was really a great feeling to see how all these pieces of the puzzle came to work and contributed to solutions.
Well, obviously, I mean, starting at LAPD and going all the way up to wearing the chief's hat and all of that, how did your, on a personal level, on what you were actually doing, how did the work change and what evolved along the way for you personally?
Well, I think one of the biggest things in any large city is demographics. And you're dealing with a lot of different populations. And it was just so fantastic for me as a young police officer working in different areas of the city. But we had a pretty good Hispanic population. Most of the people were here from Mexico, and we used to work very closely with the parishes to find out, put our finger on the pulse of activities. But by the time I became a captain in South Central Los Angeles, you had a demographic change that went from years ago white to African American and then to Hispanic. But it was very interesting dealing with the Hispanic community because there was an assumption that all Catholics or all Hispanics were Catholics. And what we found was many of the people in South Los Angeles were really from Central America and were not Catholics and were members of different fundamentalist sects. And it really changed the way in which we started to deal with people because we could no longer go to the local parish, talk to the priest to find out what was going on in the community. So that was quite an experience dealing with the new arrivals here and then convincing them that if you're the victim of a crime, you need to report it because there was, particularly back in the 80s and 90s, people just didn't feel comfortable making themselves known because they weren't here legally. And what we were finding is that we had a lot of unreported major crime. So we were dealing with that community. At the same time, you had an Asian community, particularly Koreans, that couldn't go into the Koreatown, as we called it in Los Angeles at the time. It was pretty much maxed out, so they had to go to outlying areas. And they went to a lot of the areas that I worked to set up businesses. So now you had cultural issues you had to deal with. And that continues to today. You just got people from different parts of the world that have to be integrated into the fabric of society. Well, one of the things I learned from LAPD that I really thought was great, we used to do community police academies. And what we would do them in native languages. So the captains of those communities that had, say, Japanese-speaking population, Koreans, Spanish, Armenians, what you could do is tailor a community police academy to orient the community members to the rigors of police work and civic responsibilities. They were actually conducted in the different languages. And that is a very valuable program because what I like to tell people is we are the police to the entire community, just not to the business community or the residential community that's well-to-do. We have to provide service to everybody, so we need to communicate and communicate well, build up partnerships, and it's for the good of everybody.
Well, I remember distinctly back before I moved to Southern California, I visited people I knew in Los Angeles, and I remember flying into Los Angeles at night, and I was absolutely shocked by how huge the city is. Where New York is vertical, L.A. is horizontal, and it's just massively spread out, measured in hundreds of square miles, the whole basin up there. You mentioned earlier, and I know now this is the patchwork of many demographic neighborhoods and socioeconomic neighborhoods, and it is like a quilt of humanity. You mentioned earlier about South Los Angeles, and you were the deputy chief there. I think you had, 1,600 officers or so under you. So how would you exactly define what we would call South Los Angeles, and what special challenges did you face while performing those duties?
Well, again, it's a massive area, primarily from the Santa Monica Freeway or Interstate 10 for the folks around the country, and that's a highway that goes from coast to coast. But everything on the south side down to the harbor area, which is the port of Los Angeles. So it was a huge area geographically, but many areas were very concentrated with people, and that's where you had a lot of different. As time went on, you had a lot of different ethnicities that were getting to know each other, and there were difficulties along the way. And what we needed to do is we brought a lot of specialists in from the Community Relations Service of the U.S. Department of Justice and our local Human Relations Commission folks here, because there were some situations where people didn't understand another person's intent, and we really had to engage in a lot of mediation. And we had a lot of business disputes, if you will. People in the community, for instance, were offended by the way some merchants conducted their business, because what they would do in order to avoid any type of shoplifting is only allow a certain number of people in the store at any one time. And that did cause a lot of hurt feelings. It caused a lot of protest. And I can remember spending days on end with members of our Human Relations Commission trying to unruffle those feathers and to work things out so on a go-forward basis there would be no more disputes. That, in some areas, continues until today. But that was a huge challenge. Also, what you find in the area was that there was a lot of crime. And most people don't think that everybody in every community is good. The majority of the people in communities are very, very good, hardworking people that contribute to the community. And what happens is they're a minority of people that choose to commit crime, and they do it. And in some areas, there's a certain amount of intimidation that goes on. They don't want people to report the crime. People are afraid to report it. So that was always a very interesting test for all of our officers, and that was to ensure that people had confidence in us, that they could report crime, and we weren't going to leak their names back out to suspects or do something to make the victims' identities known to the criminals in the neighborhoods. Because for quite a while, and continuing to today, you have certain gang elements that control certain neighborhoods. So that was always very trying.
Well, we'll be talking more about this as we go along, but what is meant by the term police culture? And maybe you could talk about what the culture was like at the LAPD when you first came there.
Well, when I first came to the LAPD, I think you could really characterize the culture as being a very fast pace, with young officers, many of whom were fresh out of Vietnam, that were very action-oriented, wanted to contribute. There were people that the majority of the people we worked with didn't mind that workload that was unrelenting. And so we loved working with people like that. But, and in some respects, sometimes when you are on the streets, you feel besieged. You feel that you're a minority there that's not recognized, and sometimes officers tended to relate more with other officers than they did with the community. So that's something for police administrators and police supervisors to deal with. And again, cultures can be great things, but sometimes until you're in the midst of a culture, you don't realize its power and strength. So there are good cultures, there are bad cultures, and I think today the police are looking for greater amount of approbation from the public. What you see is negative incidents that occur around the country, and out of the millions, if not billions, of police encounters nationwide annually, a small percentage are negative. They may even involve criminality by police officers, but it's a very small number. But people tend to look at all police officers based on the last negative incident they saw on television or some type of an electronic device. So what we need to do is make our officers aware that there is a lot of support for them out there, and then encourage them to do what we do best, and that's serve.
So you have seen, I think at least, I mean, just even as a citizen, I've seen a change in policing and how it's approached, I think, from certainly from the 70s till now, but even I think more recently, that there is a more conscious effort, I would say, as far as interacting with the community or reflecting the community goes. Would you agree, or how has it changed, or and what caused those changes?
Well, I think today we much better represent the community in terms of our gender and ethnicity. And as you travel around our country, you find that, and I've gone to travel the length and breadth of our country and dealt with a lot of police departments, and you can go from New York and Philadelphia, where there are large segments of minority communities, and see the officers there that are speaking Spanish or speaking Polish, whatever the language is. And you've got a much greater appreciation for where people came from. And then also, as police administrators, because we work in this culture of inclusiveness, so hopefully what we're trying to do is include people. What we're trying to do is get our officers to contribute to that inclusiveness and getting people to work together. Because no matter what major city you go to in the United States, it is populated by a lot of different groups of people that have a lot of different values. But what we need to do is understand each other's values and then move forward for the good of everybody.
Great answer. We, after all these years of law enforcement, you ultimately left the LAPD and went to work for Paramount Pictures as the Vice President of Security and Emergency Service. What prompted that, and what was that gig all about?
Well, it was quite interesting because it was a result of what happened on 9/11. And immediately after that, the Assistant Director for the FBI's Los Angeles field division met with the CEOs and a lot of the other management and executives of the motion picture industry. And as it was described to me, the FBI indicated that one of the largest studios, they didn't know which one, was more than likely targeted. And so that sent up a great deal of concern by all of the studios. So an individual I used to work for on LAPD was in charge of the security element at Paramount Pictures, and what they started to do was really improve their security by putting bollards up, very sophisticated camera systems, detection systems. And it appeared to them that I had the requisite background in terms of my special operations type activities, as well as the intelligence component, and then, of course, my ability to know some of the major players in the FBI and other federal and state agencies. So that was probably a week after the 9/11 incident. And so I started to meet with some people at Paramount, and they almost immediately offered me a position, and then I didn't really know whether I wanted to leave or not. So I was in that conundrum situation for about 6 months, knowing I had to leave at some time, and I a lot of people didn't stay as long as I did at that particular time. So I wanted to leave, but I wanted to be I was kind of attracted to the new opportunities to work on the private side of the street, but with a lot of the same partners I'd worked with previously. So I eventually decided to go ahead and take that opportunity and became the vice president of not only security, but we had our own fire department, our own hospital, got involved in environmental health and safety as well. So it was quite an interesting assignment. Worked again with a lot of the same people. We had a lot of heads of foreign states that would come and visit the studio. President Carter was there to visit some of the executives, as well as former President Reagan. So it was a very interesting experience working on the private side of the street, but dealing with a lot of the same people I had dealt with in my public service days.
Well, I imagine that was a difficult decision, because you are cutting the umbilical cord, so to speak, to what you had done your entire career. What did you see as the major difference between working in a governmental organization and then jumping over into the private sector as far as how things worked in general?
Well, certainly on the public side of the street, by necessity, there's a certain amount of bureaucracy. So you have approval processes, and it's almost a lockstep method to that madness, where you have to do one thing then the other. You can't run along parallel tracks. On the private side of the street, it probably is more efficient, and it moves along rather quickly. That was one of the big differences. Also, in the terms of personnel practices, you find that on the public side of the street, you're dealing with people generally are parts of unions and have probably more rights than private employees do, even though they might be unionized. So it was always fantastic to deal with the labor relations attorneys, particularly with all of the organized labor on the lots. So became challenging sometimes, and it was very interesting to see the differences between the private side of the street, the public side of the street, and what you find out on the private side of the street is you've got to have the money to support activities, and you don't have the money to support activities, the cuts usually come in personnel. So that's something that does happen on the public side of the street, but not to the same extent that it does on the private side of the street, because you've got a certain fiduciary relationship with the stockholders there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you didn't just work for Paramount. You also worked for another really huge corporation. It's so tempting to make a pun about it being powerful. But you worked for SC Edison, Southern California Edison, which keeps the lights on for a lot of us around here. And then you went from there to police chief in Burbank. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that period of time.
Yeah, so after 6.5-7 years, the position at Paramount ran its natural course. And then there was an opportunity. I had worked with several people from the FBI that were now affiliated with Southern California Edison. And again, this was post 9/11, and there were an awful lot of federal requirements, and particularly for the energy sector. And I was fortunate enough to work with a lot of these same people once again, and to make sure that the energy sector, particularly electricity, was well protected. And when you stop and consider how devastating it could be if the energy sector ever got infiltrated, how much we would suffer as a nation. So it was great to be involved in those issues, to make sure that it was protected. And during my course of the time there, I started receiving telephone calls about a position in Burbank. And what had happened is there had been – an incident in Burbank, and some Christopher Commission attorneys, and that those were the attorneys under the former Secretary of State Warren Christopher that investigated the LAPD after the Rodney King affair. But those attorneys came back after what we call the Rampart scandal in the late 1990s in Los Angeles. And some of the attorneys made recommendations as people that they thought could come in and deal with the issues in Burbank at the time. So I was one of those people, and I finally the adrenaline started flowing that, you know what, I think I can go there and make a contribution, and so let's go ahead and do it. So the 6 months that was originally anticipated has now become in excess of 6 years. But it's, again, been a very great experience and a great opportunity for me to morph from a department of one size to the private sector than to go back to policing, but in a different size agency.
Well, Burbank would be, I would imagine, a fairly different place from the entire southern half of the L.A. Basin that you were dealing with before. So tell us about Burbank itself. What kind of population are you serving there?
Burbank is a very unique city. Had the centennial anniversary in 2011. But when you think about Burbank, you think about two things. One is the entertainment industry, and the second is Lockheed Aircraft. So Lockheed Aircraft has pulled out, and the current Burbank Airport was a part of that entire complex at one time. The airport's called the Bob Hope Airport, and there's still aircraft-related industries here. But by and large, when Lockheed pulled out, a lot of it closed up. And then the entertainment industry is represented by Warner Brothers, which has its lot within the confines of Burbank. Disney is located in the confines of Burbank. What used to be NBC Universal Studios is now an independent operation called Burbank Studios. But then you have other allied companies here. Nickelodeon is one. The Cartoon Network, and then you've got a lot of associated activities with everything from rentals of different types of equipment used to make movies to the post-production houses. It's just anything that you can think of involving the entertainment industry is represented in the city of Burbank. City is about 104,000 people, 17.4 square miles, of which probably 10 miles is a part of the city itself. The remaining property is actually a wilderness area. And located right next to the city of Los Angeles and bisected by a lot of freeways, and very high cost of living, and an area that is attractive to a lot of people because it is safe, the safety services are great, and it's located in a position so you could get to the San Fernando Valley without any difficulty, get to downtown Los Angeles, go east into the San Gabriel Valley. So it's just ideally situated for a lot of people to want to live here because they're close to a lot of other areas that they can work. And it's just a great community spirit here. People get involved, they stay involved, and it's gratifying to see the participation of people here. Like a lot of other areas in Southern California, and because of changes in laws and in other factors, crime is starting to go up. So we've got quite a campaign right now of trying to harden the target to prevent crimes from occurring. What we're trying to do is, and people are very good here about what we call, if you see something, say something. So they're very good about self-reporting suspicious circumstances. Things that really don't occur in the big metropolitan areas occur here, which contributes to the safety of our community.
So within the police department itself, what sort of challenges did you face? Again, you're going to have a new department, so I'm imagining a culture that's different. And was that culture all right, or did it need to change?
No, it it's like any other work group. There were issues that needed to be addressed, and we worked on that. We're continuing to work on that. But having been involved in this line of work now for 46 years, we're in the business of dealing with people, and sometimes people create issues that affect other people, and you just have to deal with it. So that's what we're doing with the department. There are some other challenges out here. Right now, we didn't mention Ferguson, but we kind of alluded to the manner in which people look at law enforcement today. So for all of the agencies in California, we are experiencing a brain drain, if you will. It's very, very difficult to recruit qualified people. And a lot of it has to do, I think, with the way law enforcement is viewed today by others. And one of the other situations is you just don't decide you're going to be a police officer and become one. There's a very elaborate, elongated testing process that starts out with written exams, oral exams, physical exams, background exams, medical exams, and then you've got to see go through an entire process to get psychologically evaluated. So along the way, there are an awful lot of people that fall out, and it takes quite an investment in our time to vet people. So that's a big challenge for us right now, finding truly qualified candidates. And again, just because of some of the unique things that have happened in California in the last couple of years, there is a resurgence in crime, if you will. So we're having to do more with less right now, presents us with a lot of challenges. But it gets back to something I've already mentioned, is having those relationships with the community so that the community can take care of itself. So I talked about hardening the target. So that's getting crime prevention information pushed out to people, like on how not to be the victim of an identity theft, how to better secure your property in a parked car, the imperative to lock your car when you're away from it. For a lot of females, places that you should go when you're accompanied by other people rather than by yourself. So these are messages that we try to push out to people, whether it's through our website, through personal presentations. The city has a special channel where people can tune in and see what's going on in our particular municipality. So what we try to do is provide crime prevention material there as well. And then again, it's making sure that all parts of the city are getting their fair share of attention, because there are a lot of demands out there right now.
Well, you mentioned the difficulty in finding and retaining qualified candidates and qualified officers, and I imagine that's just one of the stack of papers on a police chief's desk. Probably most people do not really understand what the chief of police in any jurisdiction really does. What's that job really like? What's the good, the bad, and the difficult?
Well, you're in one word, you're the CEO of like a corporation is the capacity that you're in. But unlike most CEOs, police work is a 24/7 operation involving things that most people never do. And law enforcement is kind of a default service. So since you're 24/7 and other people don't work 24/7, when there's a problem, it defaults to the police department. So that becomes quite interesting to deal with. Right now we're dealing with kind of we've got a lot of folks that have mental illness issues out there. So what we've done is we actually pay for a psychologist from the LA County Department of Mental Health to be teamed with some of our officers. We formed a mental health evaluation team, because the number of people that are incapable of caring for themselves or others has just increased dramatically over the past several years. So other communities are experiencing the same thing, and they're starting to adopt the same model. So what you're constantly doing is I call it harvesting best practices. So we've created a mental health team. We've gone to predictive analytics, and we've got professionally trained, actually crime analysts that are deployed to that particular activity. So we've got to remain nimble because the problems are always moving around. The benefit of a department like this is that we're more generalist than specialist. So you've got more folks that know more about a whole lot of different things, whereas most of the other major departments are probably more specialized, and officers generally perform one function, and then when it gets too complicated, they call somebody else out to handle the remainder of it. Smaller, medium-sized agencies, you do have people that seem to have that ability to handle a whole lot more and do it well. And then, of course, the biggest aspect of the job is personnel management. And you've got people working 24/7, so there are just a myriad issues of dealing with the personnel issues that are out there. But I like it because it's a challenge. And I think I, at the outset of the program, mentioned I'm kind of action-oriented, and I like doing a lot of different things. And certainly this particular job gives you the opportunity to do that. Nothing's dull.
That's for sure. Well, what would you want the public to understand better about law enforcement? Where do you think they get it all wrong and don't really understand? I mean, especially in the current climate, what do you wish people understood about police officers' work?
That's a good question. And I will be the first one to acknowledge that not all police work is done well in all circumstances. The majority of it is, the overwhelming majority of it is, and I think people need to understand that the mistakes are made. I certainly see in California, there are systems in place to evaluate the conduct of officers. I look at the numbers of contacts that we have per year, and the number that generate complaints, and it's almost insignificant. But again, I acknowledge that things go wrong out there. We need to acknowledge when we haven't fulfilled our role in handling a situation properly. But the real dilemma today is that people, I think, have painted law enforcement with a broad brush. And that has a demoralizing effect on our police officers. So, you know, what we've done here is when by law, individuals can come in off the street and make what we call a complaint against an officer, and it has to be investigated, and there's a certain process that goes through. But at the same time, what we've done is right next to that form is we've got a form so that people can commend the officers for doing commendable police work. And it, again, the majority of our contacts are good, they're responsible, and we have a minority of contacts that end up problematic. And so we in law enforcement need to acknowledge that. We do acknowledge it. But again, you can't characterize a police agency or law enforcement in general by the actions of one or two or whatever. And I think what's happening today is people see what's happening around the country, and they look at a Ferguson situation or one of the situations that has occurred back in New York or South Carolina, and they say, well, that happens all over the country. And that's not necessarily true. But again, what you need to do as a member of the public is put yourself into the position of a police officer. And you've got to make decisions based on reasonableness, on the necessity to take the action that you're taking. And a lot of times what I have found is when we look at these incidents after the fact, we find out that we might not like the result, but the officer's conduct, when you look at it from the perspective, was it reasonable and was it necessary based on what they knew at that time, they were completely legal. And it's hard for the community members to see that. Sometimes you'll see civil suits, and a municipality, state government may lose several hundred thousand dollars because of the conduct of police officers. But what people don't understand is the elements in a civil court don't match up to beyond a reasonable doubt, which is required in a criminal court. So you don't need a unanimous verdict. And when you talk about a preponderance of evidence versus beyond a reasonable doubt, they're two different things. So it's hard. We in law enforcement need to continue to do our best to explain to people what those nuances are. We need to have good contacts in all of our communities. We need to nurture those contacts. We need to be out there. One of the things that we try to do in Burbank is we've revitalized our chaplaincy program, and we have found that we can use people from all different faiths that will go out and deal with it with community situations, that help us make death notifications, that help us when we have severely injured people in hospital, and they help us communicate with different groups of people in the community that are probably not well represented. And we found that what we've done is broken the ice, and people will, after they... I'm fond of saying to know us is to love us, because they'll find out how hardworking, how diligent, and how compassionate most, if not all, of our officers are.
Hmm. Well, you've also done a lot of work to ensure that the Burbank Police Department reflects its community. And why is that important?
Well, all of our communities change, and certainly I experienced that in Los Angeles. And you look at Los Angeles now and how diversified it is in terms of the number of starting with the gender, and then now looking at the different representation of ethnic groups. Los Angeles City has not been majority Caucasian in years, and the department is not now. The department, like the community, is primarily Hispanic. But there needs to be some type of a representation out there. And I've been to a lot of different types of community meetings where people sometimes feel more comfortable, these are community members, dealing with people of their own ethnicity in that particular language than they do trying to communicate with an officer that just speaks English. So, again, as we diversify our workforce, I think there's a greater understanding that we're all the same. Our surnames may be different, the pigmentation on our skin is different, but we all want the same thing. We're here to serve, and we want to ensure that we do it to our best ability. But when you work with folks the Rainbow Coalition, so to speak, I think it really helps people understand on the department and in the community that we all can work together, and there's a certain value added with that.
Mm-hmm. You talked a lot about how you've worked through the years and various departments worked through the years to improve community relations. What can individuals, what can the community itself and the people in the community do to ensure that their police department is doing the right thing, but also to work with the police department to make everybody safer and the job easier?
Well, that should be going on already, because people should communicate with the police department on a frequent basis. And certainly today I see that most police departments are very contemporary on their websites, and they're interactive. But all police departments have the ability to go into the community with neighborhood watch programs or some reasonable facsimile. So what you shouldn't call when you just need the police because of a police problem. But with neighborhood watch programs, it gives us the ability for people in certain neighborhoods to organize and to call the police out to provide training, sometimes just to go out and to share a cup of coffee with them. And again, that has great benefits. There are just so many things, and the communities need to be inclusive. And one of the things I learned in South Central Los Angeles, what I really thought was great, but as a young captain there, we used to go out once a month to a community member's home with all of the people that transferred in to our division. And what we do is the neighbors would come and we would just sit down and dispel a lot of myths that people on both sides have had. But what I saw during that period of time, a primarily African-American community was transitioning to an ever-increasing number of Hispanics. And what I saw some of the African-American families do is invite the Hispanics to the meetings that they had with us. And, I mean, it worked out so well that you had different cultures that never dealt with each other that were now starting to share each other's food and speak each other's languages, but now they were working hand-in-hand with the police department. So I would encourage people throughout our nation to do that. You need to know who your neighbors are. You should not get that siege mentality of us versus them, whether it's us, the public, versus the police, or one ethnicity against another. We're all here because we want a better life for ourselves and our families, and hopefully that translates into a better life for the entire community. But you do that when you open up communications, you establish partnerships. Everything's not going to be rosy, but as long as you can agree to disagree and there's a civil way of working issues out, that's what it's all about.
Great answer.
Great answer. Well, very quickly here, as we're almost out of time, unfortunately, we could talk to you, I think, three or four times, Scott, not get tired of it at all, but and I hope our listeners really take what you said tonight to heart. I met you through our work with the California Forensic Science Institute, which supports forensic science in our area in a number of ways. Why is forensic science important to you?
Well, I think when you get right down to it, and I'll use DNA as a good example, but we're not here in law enforcement just to arrest people and send them to jail. What we want to do, and we make periodically, we make arrests, and we release people. But I think like with DNA and what the forensic sciences do more specifically is it provides convincing evidence either to find somebody guilty or to vindicate them. So I love to use DNA because it is so factual. And what we find is with eyewitness testimony, it sometimes it's just not correct. But with the forensic sciences, whether it's fingerprints, DNA, it gives us 100% or should be 100% assurance that the person is either guilty or they're not guilty. But our obligation is just not to find the evidence to prove guilt, but I can remember several times in my background where I saw detectives do a great job, spend a tremendous amount of time to develop the evidence that somebody did not commit a crime. But that's a part of our obligation as well. So that's why in the forensic sciences, like in every other facet of life, it's so evolving. And what is on the cutting edge today in a couple of months could be really dated stuff. So we particularly in the Los Angeles area, I think have done a great job with our Sheriff's Department, LAPD lab, and the help from the state of California on that, particularly in DNA. And again, the first thing you want to do is prevent crime, but then if the crime does occur, you want to detect the offenders, and then hopefully you've got the forensic evidence to either convict somebody or to free the innocent.
So, Scott, thank you so much. I know our listeners are going to love this episode as much as we enjoyed talking with you today. So thank you again, and on behalf of the listeners for Crime and Science Radio and for Doug Lyle and Scott LaTosh and myself, thank you very much, everyone, for listening to us today.
Thanks,
thank
Scott.
You. Okay. Bye now.